This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. North Korea has launched its first operational tactical nuclear attack submarine, state media reporting on Friday. We get more VOA's Scott Walterman.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, who attended the launch ceremony, said arming the Navy with nuclear weapons was an urgent task. In 2019, state media showed Kim inspecting a previously unreported sub that was built under his special attention. At the time, analysts said the apparent size of the new vessel indicated it was designed to carry missiles. Scott Walterman, VOA News.
U.S. President Joe Biden is bringing an ambitious message to this weekend's G20 Leaders Summit in India. His offer for the global summit is this: whatever happens to China's economy, the United States can help fund your development. More from Reuters' Jillian Kitchener.
Biden is hoping to persuade fast-growing economies in Africa, Latin America, and Asia that there is an alternative to China's massive infrastructure plan called the Belt and Road Project, which has funneled billions of dollars to developing countries, but left many deeply in debt. Part of that pitch involves reforming the World Bank and boosting its funding under President Ajay Banga for infrastructure in the developing world. Washington thinks a rebooted World Bank could meet the Global South's needs and serve its own interests.
Jillian Kitchener reporting. Torrential rain in Hong Kong on Friday has led to widespread flooding across the densely packed city, submerging streets, shopping malls, and metro stations as authorities close schools and ask workers to stay at home. The Chinese Special Administrative Region saw the highest hourly rainfall since records began more than 140 years ago. For more news, voanews.com. This is VOA News. A cyclone that hit southern Brazil has led to flooding that has killed dozens and left thousands homeless. AP correspondent Karen Chamas has that story.
In the city of Mucum, resident Marcos Antonio Gomez walks on top of debris that was once his home. He told the AP, "The water arrived very fast. It was rising 6.5 feet an hour. After managing to flee, he came back to a scene of utter devastation. His house, amongst many, had been flattened. We're trying to recover a bit of what's left, but there's very little left. Nothing, actually. Not even clothes." But Gomez was one of the lucky ones. In one house in his hometown, rescuers found 15 bodies. I'm Karen Chamas.
Mali's interim government said Islamist militants attacked a military camp and a vessel in the northeastern section of the country Thursday, killing at least 49 civilians and 15 soldiers. Around 50 assailants were killed in response, and 3 days of national mourning declared, according to the interim government. Mali is one of several West African countries battling a violent insurgency with links to Al-Qaeda, an Islamic State that took root in the country's north back in 2012. With the start of a new school year, some cities are faced with how to accommodate large number of migrant children here in the U.S. The AP's Lisa Dwyer has that story.
Several major U.S. cities have struggled with an influx of thousands of asylum seekers who have filled up homeless shelters. Now, they must figure out resources to accommodate the influx of non-English-speaking students. New York City's shelter system was especially overwhelmed, but Mayor Eric Adams says the city's nearly 1,900 schools are well prepared to welcome migrant children into the classrooms. Others say there still is not enough resources to go around. Illegal border crossings fell sharply after the Biden administration introduced new restrictions in May, but the numbers are rising again. Families with children now account for about half of the arrests of people crossing the border illegally from Mexico, with more than 91,000 arrests in August, making it the busiest month ever for apprehensions of migrant families with children crossing the southern border. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
More than a decade after tsunami destroyed the Fukushima nuclear power station on Japan's Pacific coast, the country has begun releasing the treated wastewater on the site of the disaster. The move is sparking anger in the region, despite assurances by scientists that the process will not be harmful to the environment. Japan and South Korea have been the sites of large demonstrations against the release. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
We'll be right back. president delivers a sharp call to world leaders to ease tensions to avoid regional conflict.
I implore all leaders of East Asian countries to make the East Asia Summit Forum a place to strengthen collaboration.
Plus, Gabon's ousted president is now free to go if he wishes.
The military junta announced Bongo's freedom after Abdou Abari, head of the United Nations Regional Office for Central Africa, met the deposed leader in Libreville.
And a fish that has been around since the days of the dinosaurs is honored.
That fish waste is causing oxygen from the harbor to be depleted, and so the walking scout has less and less habitat available to it.
Today is Friday, September 8th, and this is International Edition. Good morning. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Amid sharpened geopolitical rivalry between the United States, China, and Russia, Indonesian President Joko Widodo delivered a forceful call to leaders to ease tension and avoid conflict in Southeast Asia. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittakuswara brings us this report from Jakarta, Indonesia.
At the East Asia Summit, Indonesian President Joko Widodo underscored the region's need for stability to continue its decades-long peace and prosperity.
Saya betul-betul minta.
I implore all leaders of East Asian countries to make the East Asia Summit Forum a place to strengthen collaboration, a place to strengthen cooperation rather than sharpen rivalry.
The summit brings together the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, and eight of its partners. Leaders of the U.S., China, and Russia chose to skip, sending instead their respective representatives, Vice President Kamala Harris, Premier Li Qiang, and Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov. Harris and Li held separate meetings with ASEAN, highlighting the strength of their country's ties with the bloc.
The United States has an enduring commitment to Southeast Asia and more broadly to the Indo-Pacific.
Over the past 10 years, China and ASEAN have forged ahead, hand in hand, and contributed to each other's successes.
Summit leaders focused on the global impact of the war in Ukraine, North Korea's nuclear program, China's increasing assertiveness in the South China Sea, and the crisis in Myanmar.
The conflict is exacerbating existing inequalities and vulnerabilities faced by women and girls, including sexual violence, forced marriage, and human trafficking.
The summit marks the end of Harris' three-day trip to Jakarta. She returns to Washington Thursday as President Joe Biden heads for the G20 summit in New Delhi, India. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News, Jakarta.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin are pledging deeper economic cooperation as the list of international sanctions on Russia grows. The leaders' commitment to strengthen ties, analysts say, will likely dash hopes among Turkey's Western allies of a rift between Erdogan and Putin. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Russian President Vladimir Putin pledged to increase cooperation from energy to tourism to foreign aid in their September the 4th summit at Russia's Black Sea resort of Sochi. Relations between the leaders had been cooling after Erdogan angered Moscow with his support for Ukraine's bid for NATO membership. But analysts say the outcome of the Sochi summit is a strong sign the Russian leader cannot afford to downscale relations with Erdogan. Columnist Ilhan Ulusgel for Turkey's Kısadalga news portal.
Putin cannot face losing Erdogan. I mean, that's for sure. They don't care about what Erdogan is doing in his ties with Western countries and Western institutions. They're more interested in what kind of a cooperation they can do with Erdogan. And they make cooperation in many areas.
Russian officials confirmed Wednesday that Turkey will participate with Russia and Qatar to supply 1 million metric tons of grain to 6 African countries. Under the agreement, Turkey would process the grain into flour. Turkey would also receive grain from Russia for its own market. But analysts warned that Moscow could use a deal to export stolen Ukrainian grain, breaching international sanctions and adding to broader concerns over Turkey's refusal to enforce sanctions against Russia. With sanctions getting tighter, analysts say Turkey is becoming even more important to Russia. George Volushin is with ACAMS, a financial crime watchdog.
There are many intermediaries in Turkey that help Russian interests, that help Russia procure goods from the West, including, you know, basic goods as well as very sensitive goods.
At Monday's Sochi summit, Putin and Erdogan also committed themselves to increasing bilateral trade from $70 to $100 billion, including turning Turkey into a regional hub for distributing Russian gas. However, some observers say such a move would undermine efforts by Turkey's Western allies to shut Russian energy out of international markets. The Russian and Turkish leaders at Sochi also discussed Russian companies' plans to build a second nuclear reactor in Turkey. Zal Gazimov is a professor of history and a specialist on Russia at Bonn University.
Such a meeting definitely demonstrated that the interaction grew between two sides, between Russia and Turkey, and both sides are in certain way indispensable for each other. They continue to cooperate, they continue to interact, and the number of chapters in that book of cooperation between Moscow and Ankara grew tremendously.
Deepening economic cooperation between Russia and Turkey, some analysts say, threatens to strain Ankara's ties with its Western allies as they seek to isolate Moscow and will likely dash their hopes of a break in Erdogan's close relationship with Putin. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Gabon military leader General Brice Nguema says former President Ali Bongo, who was toppled in an August 30th coup, now has his freedom and because of his health can leave the country for medical care abroad. The junta also created a transitional constitutional council. Moki Edwin Kanzeka in neighboring Cameroon spoke to analysts about what the latest developments could mean for a restoration of democratic rule in Gabon.
Le comité pour la transition et la restauration des institutions.
The voice of Colonel Orich Mafumbi Mafumbi, spokesperson of Gabon's Committee for the Transformation and Restoration of Institutions, declaring on Gabon national television that for health reasons, ousted President Ali Bongo Ondimba is free from house arrest. Mafumbi says the deposed leader can seek medical treatment abroad if he wishes. Bongo in October 2018 suffered a stroke, which left him physically impaired. He frequently visited foreign hospitals for treatment, according to Gabon's military junta. The military junta announced Bongo's freedom after Abdou Abari, head of the United Nations Regional Office for Central Africa, met the deposed leader in Libreville. Abari said Bongo is in good health and wants the preservation of peace and social cohesion in Gabon. Jean-Christophe Nang, a secondary school teacher in Bitam, a commercial town on Gabon's northern border with Cameroon, says military leader General Brice Oligui Nguema, who led the ousted president's security team, should have prohibited Bongo from leaving Gabon.
La question de la transition est le sujet vraiment à beaucoup d'enjeux.
He says Gabon needs Ali Bongo to provide information on the large fortune his family and friends have amassed from the misuse of public funds and corruption in oil exploitation deals. Nguema should watch out because Bongo, whose family has ruled for close to 60 years, and his supporters may have plans to destabilize Gabon. General Nguema took over from Bongo, who came to power in 2009 following the death of his father, Omar. The military junta also announced the creation of a transitional constitutional council and appointed Dieudonné Aba Awonu, a civilian magistrate, as president. Civilians were also appointed to govern the nine regions that make up Gabon. The junta also appointed Brigadier General Raponchombo Jude Ibrahim to manage the Libreville City Council during a period of transition. Nguema says officials of the Transitional Constitutional Council will be officially installed in the days ahead. Marie Madeleine Boransu, the country's top magistrate, served as president of the Constitutional Council from its creation until it was dissolved by the military junta last week. She says she is ready to work with Gabon's new leadership and officials appointed by the military to construct a peaceful country.
C'est
tout à fait normal, c'est dans l'ordre normal des choses.
She says she welcomes the creation of a constitutional council because Gabon has entered a new era and all of its institutions need to be rebuilt. She says she has talked with Nguema and is ready to hand over power to the president of the newly created Transitional Constitutional Council. Despite the appointment of civilians and apparent popularity Nguema has so far, the United Nations, the African Union, the Economic Community of Central African States, and the Central African Economic and Monetary Community continue to call on Gabon's military junta to hand over power to civilian rule. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Pakistan's main border crossing with landlocked Afghanistan was shut for a second day Thursday after deadly clashes between security forces from the two countries. VOA's Steve Miller spoke with Ayaz Gul in Islamabad to get the details.
This particular incident involved the Taliban security guards at the border. On their side, they were building some kind of a new border post, which the Pakistani side challenged as an illegal activity because there's a mutual understanding that no new security post will be established within a certain distance from the boundary between the two countries. So the Taliban were constructing and saying that they are trying to prevent smugglers from infiltrating in either direction. So Pakistanis warned them, but they didn't listen. They continued with the construction. So obviously then the Pakistani security forces opened fire at them to deter them from constructing this border post, which what we understand from our discussions with locals on the Afghan side is that the firing killed two Taliban border guards and injured like at least 10 Afghan civilians. On that side, we also have heard that there are casualties or injuries on the Pakistani side, primarily to the military forces there. So that happened yesterday, this incident on Wednesday. So Pakistan immediately closed the border gate, which is, it's not uncommon. It has happened in the past, but that border gate, as of this moment, remains closed. There have been several rounds of negotiations between the two sides to somehow diffuse the tension and reopen the border gate.
What's the significance and importance of this border crossing?
Well, this is the most important border point along this almost 2,600 kilometers border between the two countries. This border crossing, it is called Torkham, is vital for Afghanistan, which is a landlocked country, because that border crossing allows Afghanistan to do trade with the other countries through Pakistan and through the Pakistani land routes and Pakistani seaports. So most of the trade currently, which is happening between Afghanistan and its international partners, it's passing through this terminal, Torkham terminal. So and Pakistan is also utilizing lately this terminal to send its commercial goods to the landlocked Central Asian countries through Afghanistan. So whenever it is halted or closed, this border terminal, there are hundreds of truck convoys, that, go stranded. And, obviously they're carrying perishable goods like vegetables and fruits. So right now we know from our direct information that hundreds of such trucks have been stranded on both sides of the border.
Ayaz Gul reports for VOA from Islamabad. Ayaz, thank you very much for your time.
Recent statements by an Israeli far-right minister have reignited decades-old accusations from Palestinians who say Israel is imposing an apartheid regime by enforcing separate laws for Israelis and Pakistinians in the West Bank. Linda Gradstein brings us that story.
When Israel's hardline national security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir
Shafir was interviewed recently on Israeli TV about the latest in a wave of Palestinian terror attacks against Israelis, he made a distinction between the rights of Jews and Arabs in the West Bank, which he calls by the biblical names of Judea and Samaria.
My right, the right of my wife and my children to move around freely on the roads of Judea and Samaria, is more important than the right of movement of the Arabs.
Ben-Gvir's comments revived the decades-long controversial debate about Israel and apartheid, both within Israel and abroad. American supermodel Bella Hadid, whose father is Palestinian, sharply criticized the government on Instagram, where she has close to 60 million followers. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs said it only confirms Israel's apartheid regime of Jewish supremacy. Many Israelis object to calling Israel an apartheid state, saying that apartheid is unique to South Africa. The word apartheid means apartness in the South African Afrikaans language and refers to that country's former policy of segregation and discrimination of its citizens based on race. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a recent interview with U.S. media that the apartheid accusation against Israel is hogwash and that the real danger in the region is the desire for ethnic cleansing of Jews. Samuel Hyde is a political researcher who moved to Israel from South Africa.
Israel has never annexed the territories, and therefore Palestinians are not citizens of the state of Israel. They're their own distinct group of people who are currently in a stateless existence due to a conflict living under military occupation. But as long as Israel has not annexed those territories, it's under no obligation to grant citizenship to another group of people, and therefore it cannot be classified as a legitimate apartheid state.
But many Palestinians say that even if Israel has not officially annexed the West Bank, it has controlled the territory for more than 50 years. Israeli settlers living in the West Bank are governed by Israeli civil law, which gives them rights and freedoms that are denied to the Palestinians, who are governed by Israeli military law. Sam Bahur is a Palestinian-American businessman living in Ramallah.
By Ben-Gvir basically confirming Jewish supremacy, he is just saying what I believe anyone with eyes and ears and is looking at this situation has recognized for a very long time, including all of the mainstream human rights organizations. This is apartheid in full color.
Many pro-Israel organizations say that accusing Israel of apartheid is a form of anti-Semitism because it's used disproportionately to attack only the Jewish state and not the many governments around the world that perpetrate human rights abuses. Dan Diker is the president of the Jerusalem Council for Public Affairs, a pro-Israel research organization.
Apartheid anti-Semitism has become a branded slur against the state of Israel in toto. People are throwing out this nomenclature, which is essentially erasure towards the Jewish state, and that replaces erasure of the Jewish people.
As Israel approaches the 30th anniversary of the Oslo peace accords with the Palestinians that created the framework for a two-state solution, a permanent agreement remains evasive. Observers say the practice of enforcing separate sets of laws for the two peoples on the same territory will continue to fuel accusations of apartheid. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Australia on Thursday marked its National Threatened Species Day, and conservationists are calling for more efforts to save the endangered Maugean skate. The fish has been around since the dinosaurs, but could become the world's first ray or shark to become extinct in modern times as a direct result of human activity. Phil Mercer rounds us out.
The Maugean skate is an ancient fish found in only one place in the world, in Macquarie Harbour, on the west coast of Tasmania, Australia's southern island state. Its habitat covers about 100 square kilometres, but its numbers have fallen sharply because of low oxygen levels and poor water quality. It's estimated that the Maugean skate population has decreased from around 3,000 to 1,500 in recent years. Macquarie Harbour has increasingly become industrialised with salmon farming and hydroelectricity generation. It has a narrow, shallow entrance and isn't regularly flushed out by water from the open ocean. Alexia Wellbelove is the Threatened Species Campaign Manager at the Australian Marine Conservation Society. She tells VOA that waste from salmon farming is causing degradation in the area.
That fish waste is causing oxygen from the harbour to be depleted, and so the Morkian skate has less and less habitat available to it. And when it lays its eggs in the muddy bottom, those eggs just aren't getting the oxygen they need to turn into live young. This is reaching critical point. We need to figure out how we can get oxygen into this harbour.
Skates are flat, rectangular animals that are similar to rays, but have a short, thick tail and lay eggs in the mud. Scientists fear they could become extinct within 10 years or be wiped out by extreme weather. Well, Beloved says Australia needs to do more to protect vulnerable species.
If we are losing species, it means our oceans and our land is not healthy, and we need to be learning how we can do better to have the healthiest possible environments in which we live.
While the Morgian skate is currently listed as endangered, its conservation status is being reassessed. Tanya Plibersek, the Federal Minister for the Environment and Water, said in a statement Thursday that the government had to act fast to bring it back from the brink of extinction. The skate is one of 110 species prioritised for recovery under Australia's Threatened Species Action Plan. Plibersek also said that the government would invest more than $1.3 million to set up a captive breeding program to help save the Morgian skate. National Threatened Species Day is held every year in Australia on September 7, the anniversary of the death of the last Tasmanian tiger in 1936. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you a good day, good health, and good news tomorrow. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
60 years ago, on September 10, 1963, the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty entered into force. Also known as the Partial Test Ban Treaty, it banned nuclear weapon tests in the air, on land, and in water. The treaty significantly reduced nuclear fallout beyond the test sites, and therefore beyond national borders. 33 years later, 186 nations signed the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, forbidding all nuclear tests. But despite the great impact of the 1963 Limited Test Ban Treaty and the norm it fostered, the goal of a global legally binding ban on all nuclear weapon test explosions by all states, parties, in all environments remains elusive, said Bonnie Jenkins, Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, before the UN General Assembly. The vital final step to reaching that goal is the entry into force of the CTBT. The treaty is remarkably successful. Inasmuch as nuclear tests are forbidden, it is more difficult for states to develop and field new warhead designs. However, eight states, including the United States, have so far failed to ratify the CTBT. Their adherence to the treaty relies on voluntary moratoria.
For more than 30 years, the United States has not conducted a nuclear explosive test, and we have no plans to do so. We were the first to sign the CTBT when it opened for signature in September 1996. Since then, the United States has maintained a zero-yield moratorium on nuclear explosive testing and calls on all states possessing nuclear weapons to declare or maintain such a moratorium.
While these voluntary moratoria help to maintain the international norm against nuclear explosive testing, we also recognize that there is no substitute for the legally binding ban that an in-force CTBT will provide. Such a ban is in the interest of all states, said Undersecretary Jenkins.
A legally binding ban on nuclear explosive testing remains an international priority. The NPT parties recognize once again that a ban on all such testing in all environments is an important and necessary step on the path to a world without nuclear weapons.
Despite the difficult international security environment in which we find ourselves today, said Undersecretary Jenkins, all states must recommit to the goal of a globally legally binding ban on nuclear explosive tests as an important milestone on the road to a world without nuclear weapons.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.